In this first part of the show, we'll be talking about ballistic missile defense. Just a couple of weeks ago, President Bush made a speech and outlined his intentions to build such a system for the United States. And certainly that should have come as no surprise because it was something that he talked about during the presidential campaign. This discussion of building this system has been received rather negatively by many countries around the world. Our allies, the Germans, the French, the British, they're not terribly high on the concept. And also those countries where our relationship is a bit more problematic, the Russians, the Chinese, are also not terribly happy. Within the arms control community as well, people are very concerned about building such a system because they say that it is inherently destabilizing and could indeed touch off a new nuclear arms race around the world. We'll be talking a little bit about the basics here this morning, and I'm sure in weeks and months to come we'll be talking about this some more. We'll try to provide you a variety of points of view, but we wanted to take up the discussion here once again this morning, and we're doing that with Julian Palmore. He's professor of mathematics here at the University of Illinois. He is a research mathematician. And in mathematics, he's interested in things like chaos theory and celestial mechanics, but he's also interested in military operations research, and specifically topics such as weapons of mass destruction, their delivery systems, and recently he has written and published a number of articles dealing with ballistic missile defense and national missile defense. He's a member of the board of directors of the Military Operations Research Society and is editor of Phalanx, the Bulletin of Military Operations Research, and he's with us this morning in studio. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, 800-222-9455 is the number. And, of course, anyone's welcome to call. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep things moving along, but questions, comments are welcome. Well, thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
When Mr. Bush made this speech, he said that he would like the United States to go ahead and build this system. However, at this point, it seems that we're rather short on details. We don't really know what the system would look like. We don't really know how much it would cost. From what you know and what there is out there circulating, can we say something about what this system would look like?
Well, President Bush is considering a number of options, sea-based interception, boost phase interception, as well as the ground-based interception, which was pretty much part of the Clinton plan. The problem is nothing's been decided, as far as I know, and the estimates for the cost of the Clinton plan ran between $60 and $100 billion for the various capabilities. So it's very sketchy at the moment. I heard the speech. I read the speech. Nothing is certain except that President Bush seems to not like the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, very much. And it looks as if he is inclined to try to, let's say, abrogate that treaty.
Well, perhaps we should talk a little bit about that, because that is indeed a key point. The concern is that if we would go ahead and build this system, that it would violate this treaty that we and the Soviet Union signed back in 1972. And within the arms control community, there's a great deal of concern about this. Maybe we should talk a little bit about, in simple terms, what the ABM treaty is all about.
Okay, I've got a wonderful a brief review from the New York Times on May 1st, and this was in conjunction with President Bush's speech. And the ABM treaty has really four main parts for 1972, and then it was amended in 1974, and then there have been additional amendments and various agreements in the 1990s. But, for example, one of the principal ideas is not to deploy or provide a base for ABM systems for defense of the territory of the country, of its country. So, in other words, a country is prohibited from building a system that would defend the entire country. That's one of the items. A second item is not to develop, test, or deploy multiple interceptor missile launchers or rapid reload features for ABM launchers. So, in other words, what happened in the 1990s was a recognition that theater missile defense was an important aspect of missile defense, that is, providing local protection throughout a region against missiles such as Scuds and so on. But the ABM treaty is really aimed toward strategic missiles, those with capabilities of more than 3,500 kilometers range. And so what you have is a treaty which was set up to prevent certain things from being built which would attempt to defend the whole country.
Mm-hmm. And again, the idea there was that the thinking on both sides was, if we have a system that would allow us to shoot down incoming ICBMs from the Soviet Union, then it might make it more conceivable. We could think about launching an attack against the Soviet Union, because then we would blunt their ability to retaliate.
Well, for 45 years, we based our strategic policy, and I think the Soviet Union based its strategic policy, on mutually assured destruction. And so an ABM system would interfere with that thought, and the idea was to, independently of how much was spent on offensive weapons, to keep them in check. And the ABM treaty was part of that process of keeping these weapons in check.
Hmm. I know that there are some people who make the argument that things have changed greatly from 1972. First of all, they would say, we entered into this agreement with the Soviet Union, and there is no more Soviet Union. So on that level, some people might say, well, that in a sense, that makes the treaty moot, because the party that we negotiated with, we entered into it with, doesn't exist anymore.
There's a Passover clause in that sense, that if the countries which signed the treaty cease to exist in some form or another, it passes to the people, the descendants of those countries. And so that's what we have, I think, for the ABM treaty.
Another argument that would be made either against abiding by the treaty or for those people who would say, well, it's no big problem, they might say that we really don't need to care what they think, either on that level, or to say that there's no reason to have the ABM treaty anymore, because that this was all about potential superpower conflict, and the other superpower is not there anymore. So what do we need the ABM treaty for now?
Well, I think one of the answers to that is that we need international cooperation in economics on a global scale. We need cooperation in arms control. We need cooperation from among the participating countries, especially those that have nuclear weapons and ICBMs. ICBM capability. So this is part of that cooperation. And without cooperation, if we go our own way and tend not to cooperate with other countries, we're going down a path which has a very bad ending to it.
Mm-hmm. And is it clear that if we did build the kind of system that we're talking about building, that would indeed be a violation of the treaty? Is there any way, by making modifications in the kind of system that exists, that we can sneak around it and say, oh, well, this doesn't really violate the treaty?
Well, I've got to go to the other 2 points here in the New York Times article. I know, David, you're just waiting for this. So we'll go to the next step. Not to develop, test, or deploy ABM systems or components that are sea-based, air-based, space-based, or mobile land-based. So I think that answers your question.
That sounds like
no
way
around it.
To get around it.
Right. There's no way around it. And the fourth point is not to transfer to other states or deploy outside its national territory ABM systems or their components. And so we have a prohibition from the ABM treaty on several basic things which any administration which builds the national missile defense is going to run up against. But mm-hmm. So the problem here is that, first of all, we don't have a system. It isn't as if there are things out there that work consistently, work reliably, have been verified and validated, are credible, and everybody believes that if we field this system, no one will launch an ICBM against us. I mean, there's nothing like that in sight. And so with that in mind, we're talking about essentially a fictitious system. So all of the concern, all of the, concern on the Europeans and Canada and other countries regarding what happens when we field the system? Well, right now, nothing happens because we don't have it. So it's a matter of what state are we in, and that's where we stand. Mm.
We have a caller. We will get to them in just a moment. I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Julian Palmore. He is a research mathematician here at the University of Illinois. And in addition to being interested in mathematical research, he's also interested in military operations research and such subjects as weapons of mass destruction and their delivery systems. And he has done some writing on this issue, on ballistic missile defense. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. Your questions certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
I find this topic very interesting because I favor the missile defense system, but I'd like to ask your guest, what happens if we don't build a system and we rely on this sort of can't-we-all-just-get-along theory? And 20 or 30 years from now, we have another Saddam Hussein or another Adolf Hitler who maybe builds a system and then gives our president an ultimatum. What do we do then?
Well, I think one of the aspects of this whole discussion is to consider what are all the threats out there. And ballistic missile defense is a solution, perhaps, for one very, very specific problem, and that is the problem of a country or a state or some group launching an ICBM at the United States. If the threat were to change slightly, for example, from ballistic missiles to cruise missiles, the National Missile Defense, as currently envisioned, would have nothing to do with that. So I think with regard to weapons of mass destruction, the threat spectrum of terrorism, the threat spectrum of other weapons more easily used than fielding an enormously expensive defense against an enormously expensive offense, one has to consider opportunity costs. If we spent $60 to $100 billion in this direction, what can we fail to do in other directions which are perhaps more of immediate concern? So if the ballistic missile threat is 20 years down the road, and I'm not talking about theater missile defense, I'm talking about really a national missile defense where one considers ICBMs, then what have we lost in the meantime, which we really need to protect ourselves against? So it's not a matter of cooperation in the sense that that's all we do. We have to protect ourselves, but we have to protect ourselves with the immediacy of the threats and not necessarily what happens 20 years from now.
Well, history always fascinated me. And this this topic reminds me of what they said in the 1920s. Why do we need aircraft carriers or why do we need airplanes? Because we have two oceans that will protect us. And so we don't need all of these things, and we were sadly disillusioned. I just think that we need this defense because I'm looking down the road towards China. We're having trouble with him, North Korea, Iran, Iraq. A lot of these renegade nations, Libya, that eventually will get this technology, and you just don't know where they're going to go with it.
Well, that's an important point. The problem here is twofold. One is, do we spend our money in this direction to field, to actually deploy a system? Right now, we can't make a decision on that because we don't have such a system. So the other part of this concern is let's continue with trying to get ballistic missile defense to work. And I think everyone is pretty much in favor of that. I've talked to people who are opponents of the National Missile Defense System in terms of deployment. What we want is realistic testing for national missile defense so that, in fact, if we field a system, it will be something that will work and not just be putting interceptors in holes in the ground without any credibility.
Well, we have 20 years, so we can do things 20 years from now that we can't do today. So I just think we ought to get to work on it, but I thank you for your time and for letting me ask the question.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And certainly other questions and comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. It is the case, at least as far as what I have read, is that the administration is pressing for getting something together quite quickly. In fact, they're talking about the possibility of having some kind of system, maybe not the best system, maybe not the ultimate system, but some kind of system in place actually within about 3 years.
Yes, I've heard that too, 2004. The point is, whatever happens, is it going to be credible? Is it going to be credible to the people who might try something against the U.S. or not? And if we field, whatever we field, no matter how incredible it is, if it's credible to an opponent, then it makes sense. On the other hand, if it's incredible to us and incredible to the opponent, then it doesn't make any difference because, first of all, it may not work. Secondly, it may be a complete nonsense. Mm.
As far as I know today, there are, I think it's true, there are four nations that are capable of launching an intercontinental ballistic missile against the United States: Russia, China, France, and Britain. And I guess we can assume that the French and the British probably are not going to do that. I guess we're not at this point. I think probably we think the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't either. But there also is this long list of countries that we know has made definite plans to move in this direction. And the caller mentioned some of them: Iran, Iraq, the North Koreans. And so then the question is, well, realistically, if we do believe that the day will come when those countries would also be able to do this, how long would it take? At what day do we think they would have that capability? What are some of the most realistic estimates of when those countries might have that capability?
Well, I've seen estimates anywhere from 5 to 15 to 20 years down the road. The point is that in the Cold War days of 45 years or so, from essentially 1950 to, let's say, the mid-1990s, we were faced with lots of ICBMs in the Soviet Union and its descendant countries and so on. We never had the problem with accidental launches with all these thousands of missiles and warheads out there. The other thing is that it's a matter of infrastructure within a country. I mean, ICBM is not something one buys off the shelf and just sets up in a field and then is ready to go. It's a matter of a whole infrastructure required, and this infrastructure is detectable. It's detectable from space. It's detectable from people on the ground. You know when things are being built. It's not the sort of thing that you hide in a cave and pull out and shoot off once, because it's like the old story about shooting at the king. If you miss, you're in trouble. And so it's really a matter of the nature of the whole problem involved with ballistic missiles. And ballistic missiles are not just ICBMs. I mean, you have submarine-launched ballistic missiles. The British and French have these. The Russians have these. And so a submarine-launched, then you've got cruise missiles. You've got all sorts of missiles to think about. And a national missile defense only thinks about a very small aspect of this whole problem. Mm-hmm. And so $60 to $100 billion spent on a very narrow aspect may not be a good choice.
Yeah. And I think that it certainly is true that some people have pointed out the fact that here we're talking about a potential threat. We suspect that someday we may face this threat, but we don't know when. We don't know who might be providing this threat. But that we do know, we actually have experienced the threat of the theater missiles, Scuds, shorter range missiles. American troops have actually been under fire with these weapons, and the defense we have against them is highly inadequate. And there, I think some of what I have read about this, some people say they're really surprised that there isn't more concern in Congress and in Washington about this, which is a real and present danger, as opposed to the other thing that is there but is maybe somewhere in the future.
Well, I want to step back a bit. I agree with you. I want to step back a bit to World War II. When the V-2 attacks, the German rocket, were launched on London in September 1944, that was the start of the V-2 bombardment, and it went on for 9 months. The British had some defense against V-2s, but it isn't the sort of thing we're talking about today. What they did was to find out where the launch sites were and go after them. They found out where the production facilities were and went after those. And so what you've got is a situation where there are a lot of ways you can defend against ballistic missiles without having an interception capability. I mean, the British were even considering, once they knew a V-2 was in the air, firing anti-aircraft guns more or less at random over London to put up some sort of metal shield for the V-2 to run into. The only problem with this is about 2% of the shells wouldn't detonate in the air, and so they thought that there would be more damage on the ground from this than, let's say, the V-2 would cause by itself. Now, there were two terrible incidents with V-2s. One hit a marketplace and killed several hundred people. Another hit a department store and killed several hundred people. And these were very unusual events. Most of the time, the V-2s came down. They would bury themselves in the ground, at least the warhead, for a few feet. There was much, apparently, less damage from a V-2 hit than from a V-1 hit, the buzz bomb. And about 10 times as many buzz bombs were fired at London than V-2s. And so what you have is the cruise missile threat as well as the ballistic missile threat. And the British were very good at thwarting the cruise missile threat using proximity fuses and anti-aircraft and also fighters.
Hmm. We have another caller here. Let's go to them, Champaign County. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. You started off the show by reviewing Bush's speech and said that it doesn't really lay out a vision, but what about Rumsfeld's report when he was chosen to be head of the Space Commission? And there's some document, a huge garish 1 megabyte PDF file called Vision 2020 that is at peterson.af for Air Force, .af, and then .mil for military site. You can find it there. It's the site of the U.S. Space Command. And it has a vision of something that is not missile defense. It's called War from Space. And the last line in this Vision 2020 is space, the warfighter's edge, or something like that. So there are a lot of people out there that have visions of what this is going to be. Obviously, is you could say that this is, you know, going to be hashed through the political system, and that's changed a little bit just in the last couple of days. But there's a huge military-industrial complex that's just fighting over the right to build this stuff. I mean, we have this new striker fighter plane that Boeing and Lockheed Martin are slathering over. Up to 5,000 of those or something like that. I forget what the total cost is. So there is, I just think it's a little disingenuous. I don't mean to be critical, because you're saying a lot of, I think, reasonable things, that it doesn't really do a lot. There are a lot of ways around it, and I didn't even mention decoys, which are apparently rather cheap. But this whole idea of a forward-deployed sea and then lasers, weapons from space, is, I mean, this Vision 2020 enshrines the Patriot missile, which was a total fraud. I mean, it didn't knock any Scuds down. If it did, it was by accident. I think it was a 2% hit or something like
Pardon
that.
Pardon me, but what's your question?
My question is, would you react to some of this? Have you looked at the Rumsfeld Space Commission report? Have you looked at Vision 2020?
Yeah, but I would like to make
it. And that's why I'm a little antagonistic, because you come off saying that, well, Bush didn't say much about what's going on, but I'm sure you've done other research and you know what I'm talking about. And there's a juggernaut that's ready to spend this money. And
Well, pardon me, but there are always juggernauts ready to spend money. I mean, this is the fountain of funding you're talking about, $60 to $100 billion. And I feel that the point here is that President Bush did not propose a plan, and visions are not plans. You've got to have hardware, you've got to have designs, you've got to have things that work, and right now we don't have that. So regardless of 2020, 2010, I mean, there are all kinds of artist conceptions of how things would work, but artist conceptions are not what you spend $20 billion on or $100 billion on. For example, to give you a for instance, when I worked for NASA in the early 60s, I was in Huntsville at the Marshall Space Flight Center, and I was present during discussions of how to go to the moon. Now, President Kennedy, in May of 61, had announced that's what we're going to do, and we're going to do it by the end of the decade, and we're going to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. That was the goal, it very simply expressed. And so in 1962, people were very concerned about just how to do it. And, of course, the rocket technology had gone back from the, you know, it had been around since the early 1920s with Goddard and the Germans and all sorts of people working on rockets for 40 years prior to this. And so what we have is a situation in 1962 where a guy, John Hobalt at Lewis Research Center, I believe, in NASA, had come up with an idea. He had invented an idea of lunar orbit rendezvous. And that was the key to success, because before then, it was considered a sort of matter of fact that we would do an Earth orbit rendezvous using two launch vehicles mated in Earth orbit and then go direct to the moon and come back direct from the moon. Well, that would not have worked under the circumstance. Too much weight, too much unreliability, too much of everything. And so when the lunar orbit rendezvous was proposed, there was a very careful look at that for about 6 months. And then it was decided, in fact, that was doable. Even though there were communications problems, there were lots of things which needed to be done, a direction was set. We do not have such a direction now. And believe me, we need it. If we're going to field something that works, if we field something that doesn't work, and we spend $60 to $100 billion doing it, then I feel, really, that's a mistake.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that, and that's an important point to make, that the vision isn't the plan. But I'm just saying there's a lot of lobbying money, there's a lot of intensity, and there, if you look at Rumsfeld's report, it actually has, you know, language in it about how the global situation is going to get worse, and we're going to have to be, you know, the economic situation is going to get worse, so we're, instability is going to be increased, so we have to go ahead with, you know, being able to control things from space. Well, there's an alternate vision, and that's to do something on the ground for the people in the world, you know, and it's not Lily Lyle. You know, it's partly self-interest, it seems to me, that you don't want this kind of instability that's racking Africa to go on. And there's things that the U.S. can do, and I regret to say that it's actually done counter things, and it's actually increased the instability in a myriad number of ways, but that's another issue. But I think people should go to these sites and look at this stuff, because this kind of fantasy has been around for a long time, and it's driven the defense budget for many, many years. And I'll hang up and see what other people...
Well, what I'd like to say, just in passing, I mean, I appreciate your comments. What I just want to say is that I believe we are having a national debate about national missile defense, and I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. We need to talk about it. We need to get it out in the open, see what's required, what makes sense, and by all means, people should float their plans, but we need to see plans.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have other callers we'll get right to, and I should again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Julian Palmore. He is a research mathematician at the University of Illinois and is certainly interested in mathematical research, but also in military operations research. He's written on ballistic missile defense and national missile defense. He's a member of the board of directors of the Military Operations Research Society, and we're here talking about ballistic missile defense and where we stand at this point in this country with this discussion and whether it's going to go further than just being a discussion. The number, if you'd like to call in, questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller in line, Urbana. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. It seems to me that the whole idea of a defense is fundamentally flawed, that a defense is reactive, and therefore it's always several steps behind the current, or at least the near future, offensive developments in technology. And therefore there is absolutely no way you can build a defense which will remain effective for more than a very short time. It seems to me the last effective defense that had any lifetime to it was in the Middle Ages, when castle defenses were fairly effective for a couple of hundred years, and that since that time defensive systems have always gone out almost as quickly as they were developed. French warfare in the First World War was obsolete well before the end of the Second World War, First World War, when the tank was introduced. I think that's been the case with all strictly defensive systems.
Well, I think you raise an interesting point. One has to make a distinction between technology and its use in terms of particular technical defenses and the use of ideas as defense, for example, mutually assured destruction as preventive defense. So what you have is really the things you build and deploy is one type of defense, and the other is the use of ideas to keep an opponent at bay.
Exactly. I think the only effective defense is a very strong offensive system. or at least one that is punishing enough that nobody is going to be tempted to attack.
So that's a sort of a preventive defense.
Yes. But it doesn't rely on a strictly defensive system, which is supposed to render some offensive system ineffective.
Well, that's, you're, I think, also thinking about a reactive defense. In other words, you let the offense take its shot, and then you try to defend against that shot. The British, on the receiving end of the V-2s in World War II, in 1944-1945, really took, they had passive defense from evacuating threatened areas and that sort of thing to active defense and going after the production and the launch sites for the V-2. And so you have defensive maneuvers which combine countermeasures, offensive, let's say, moves to try to stop this other offense from the adversary.
Well, the Israelis, in fact, tried something very similar to that when they destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor back in, when was that, the 60s?
No, I think it was around 1980.
Was it that late?
Yeah, it was pretty late.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It must have been. And was certainly fairly effective. It's a drastic measure, but...
Well, that was preemptive. I mean, there you are doing something with the thought that things will get worse than get better. And that's a matter of infrastructure. If you see infrastructure being prepared, being built, where, let's say, you know what the infrastructure is for example, ICBM production facilities or some such thing, in the end, one might decide to do something about the infrastructure being built in another country rather than mount a $60 to $100 billion defense against a very specific threat which may not materialize.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'm enjoying your talk.
All right. Thanks for the call. You explained a little bit earlier that for a long, long time that there was this idea that there was the standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union based on this concept of mutually assured destruction. The idea being that each side, the nuclear arsenal was so large and the real possibility of massive retaliation was so large that neither side would think about launching a first strike because it would be a lose-lose proposition. Now it seems that we are talking about something different, and we're not talking about a superpower conflict. We're talking about the quote-unquote rogue state, where we even speculate that the kind of reason and the logic that lied behind mutually assured destruction doesn't apply anymore, and that we would have someone who would launch, who would might willingly launch an attack on the United States with a handful of missiles, just a couple. So even knowing that massive retaliation was a real possibility. I mean, have we abandoned the idea that there's reason lying behind this kind of decision?
Oh, you mean whether everybody's rational?
Yeah, exactly.
I think there are a lot of irrational players in the world. What I'd like to say, though, is that the only thing I feel that makes sense in terms of ICBM attack is to use a nuclear weapon because, frankly, biological and chemical are more easily delivered in a suitcase than they are through ICBM. The technology is there for these sorts of weapons where you don't have to build an ICBM or buy an ICBM or have the infrastructure to mount an ICBM attack. The other thing is, if an ICBM contained a nuclear warhead, you've got to get the nuclear warhead. That means you either have to have the infrastructure to design, build, test, etc., the nuclear warhead, or you buy the nuclear warhead, but you still don't know it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And so what you're faced with are two massive infrastructure requirements for a rogue state out there. They're very expensive technologies, and it's not sort of off the shelf. I mean, you just don't go out and buy the ICBM from the local store, and you buy the nuclear warhead from the next local store, and you put them together, and it works. It's a matter of credibility here, and even the irrational actor out there has a lot to lose.
Just one further question. I promise the people who are on hold, I will get right to them. When Ronald Reagan first proposed this idea, he was talking about a system that would be able to defend against a massive attack from the Soviet Union. And he outlined this idea of a protective umbrella that would virtually guarantee that nothing would get through. Very quickly, a lot of people in the scientific community and elsewhere said That's just not possible. There's no way that we could build a system that would be that tight and that we would expect a substantial number of missiles to get through and that would cause unimaginable damage, even if just a handful of missiles got through. Now we're talking about something different. We're talking about designing a kind of a system that would protect against either an accidental launch. So we might just have one missile we're talking about. It might be a couple. Or, again, the kind of idea that we were talking about here, where we would have an adversary that would have limited capability. And so we would be talking about, instead of trying to shoot down hundreds of missiles, here now we might be talking about one or two or five. And some people would say, in the previous case, there's no way that we could design something that would do that. But here, this is a more, it's more conceivable that we could, because the objective here is much more limited. Given that, and given the fact that technology has improved over this time that we've been thinking about that, does it now become more reasonable to think that we could, we'd say today we can't do that, but is it more reasonable to say that, well, maybe in 5 years or 10 years, we actually could have a system that would work?
Oh, I think it's important to continue trying. I mean, we need to get the technology straight. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about a rush to deployment without adequate testing. I'm concerned about a rush to deployment of something which, even if it were to work, would be the wrong move. So it's really a matter of what's the right move in a situation like this. Let me give you a for instance. Suppose the Russians and we were terribly concerned about the Russians' command and control structure on their missiles. And suppose that both nations felt the command and control structure, because of economics and other reasons, morale and so on, was very weak. Then an obvious thing to do would be for us to try, with the Russians' cooperation, to strengthen their command and control system so that accidental things didn't happen. So, I mean, there you have alternatives to building costly systems which will not do the job you need to do. In other words, if you're worried about accidental launches, let's make the command and control structure reliable so we're less concerned about that.
Well, let's talk with some other callers. The next is Effingham. Line 4, hello.
Yes. Didn't the Bush administration reduce the amount of funding that was being used to help monitor the Russian sites, their launch sites and such, and so we no longer will have the ability to monitor those sites? And also, I would like to suggest the system will cost trillions of dollars, not billions, and it can still easily be fooled with decoys. And we should be spending our resources on finding a replacement for petroleum-based fuels. And even if it works, a rogue nation could send a bomb in on a freighter in one of our harbors. Thank you.
Yeah, right. Thanks for your comment. I think the principal point here is that even if it were working, and one can think of policy decisions based on, let's suppose the system worked, and it worked as advertised, and if we fielded it, it would be credible. What do we have when we do that? In other words, let's go beyond the technology debate and say, all right, 5-10 years from now, it will work, and it will work to a certain 0.9 probability of hitting an incoming missile. Then what? In other words, then do we field it, or do we do other things to thwart bombs in suitcases or chemical or biological attack, nuclear weapons shipped in on, let's say, in ports? It's interesting to note that the letter which Einstein signed to President Roosevelt along around 1939, encouraging the development of atomic energy and in particular the possibility of an explosive device, mentioned specifically that such a device could be carried into a harbor on a ship and exploded, doing damage to the harbor and the surrounding territory. So there was the first instance of the thought that these weapons would not be delivered by air or other means, that they would be delivered just on a barge.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, last time we talked about this on the show, this was when President Clinton was still in office, and it was at the point where the administration was making this decision, do we go ahead with the research program, do we not? And that was when they were doing some testing, and the testing wasn't going well. And then the administration decided just to leave this, and that'll be on President Bush's plate. But when we did that, that was the point that people called in and made over and over and over again. They said, well, now, look, there is this real possibility that this such a device could be delivered in a much simpler way, and that we have no defense against that. So that's not an unreasonable scenario that somebody might do that, might be able to build the device and sail it in on a boat or bring it in a truck or bring it in a suitcase come in under the radar, so to speak.
Well, I should, yeah, David, I agree. And I think that one has right now about $10 billion a year being spent on counterterrorism, which is exactly in that direction, to look at nuclear, chemical, biological, conventional, high-explosive weapons, and to try to thwart their deployment in this country.
Let's talk with someone else. Gibson City, I think, here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. May I go ahead with my question?
Yes, please.
Are you acquainted with the organization called the Society of Old Crows, and have they or any of their members weighed in on this particular question?
That's a good one. I'm not sure what that refers to. It seems to me I may have heard that name. I have no idea what it means.
I can expand. They are an organization of people who are interested in game theory as applied to conflict situations.
Ah, okay. That pins it down, yeah.
Some of them are deeply interested in national defense problems. It occurs to me that some of them might have weighed in on this particular question, and I'm wondering if you are aware of any such.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm not an old crow, so I'm not privy to this group. But on the other hand, where are some of these folks located?
I don't know.
I'm thinking of various service schools, Naval Postgraduate School. I know some older people there who might be old crows, for that matter, but I have no idea. I think I've heard that name mentioned maybe in the past, but it's I wouldn't have recalled it without your mentioning it.
Uh-huh. Well, if they still exist, and I think they still do, you might find them an interesting group. And if you have no further comments, that closes my question.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We'll just go on then. We'll go to Chicago here for someone else. This is line two. Yes.
Thank you. On this Memorial Day weekend, it serves us well to remember the ravages and folly and irony of war, and to think of surrender to peace. We can only think of war and the devastation that it occurs in, but if we begin to think of the constructive, creative things that have resulted since then, such the point where our enemies, Germany and Japan, upon surrender, have gone on to apply their energies to becoming the economic power and stature that they had hoped to attain through war, but they attained it through peace. So if we can shift our mentality and focus upon the benefits that will accrue to our humanity and invest all that resource and funds and so forth towards getting closer to that attainment, we will be better served than thinking of these shortstop measures of retaliation and offensive and things. We can go back to the time of the Civil War just briefly. You had a guest on the Civil War the other day recounting of surrender of Lee to Grant and the Union status and his repelling the idea of a guerrilla warfare being maintained as not being constructive and destructive. And so we can get closer to the things of peace, we will be far better off. Thank you.
All right. Fine comment. Do you want to follow up on that at all?
No, I'm fine.
Not much to add. One of the concerns that has been raised here is that if we should go ahead and develop and deploy this system and it should complicate our relations now with Russia, that this will undercut the effort that we and they have been engaged in trying to dismantle weapons of mass destruction. Do you think that that is a possibility?
Well, I think there are a lot of possibilities. One comment I want to make on an earlier note that you had, David, was that the Clinton decision was not to deploy a national missile defense based on the state of the testing and the state of the technology last summer. On the other hand, we're talking about deployment decisions, and the technology is not there yet. And so it's really a matter of, as I mentioned before, people are interested in perfecting technology, pushing it, seeing how far it can work. On the other hand, to deploy systems without knowing that they work is really money not well spent. Hmm. So That's yeah, but I mean, there are a lot of possibilities. I think the threat of terrorism is certainly uppermost in a lot of people's minds, and a lot of money is being spent trying to decide how best to cope with this thing. In other words, to stop it before it starts. That's preventive defense, and it's a very major, plays a very major role in all of the people's thinking about this.
Well, do you actually think that it's likely that the United States would deploy a system that we thought didn't work, or that we thought, well,
no,
maybe it'd work sometimes and
no,
maybe it'd work
not. What we would do is deploy a system which we thought we'll fix it as we build it, which is a very risky proposition. And in fact, the acquisition process in this country in the Department of Defense is based on let's make schedule-driven decisions rather than event-driven decisions. And the event-driven decisions are we build it, it works, now we do something else. Schedule-driven means that on March 1st you do something, on April 1st you do another thing, and when testing slips or when anything doesn't work, hey, it's in the schedule. It's got to be there.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. There are a lot of distinctions here, and it is, I think there's more game theory aspect to this whole problem than a lot of people realize.
Try and get one more caller quickly here in Chicago, line four.
Hi.
Yes.
Seems to me you're operating on the wrong basis, and that is that we have an administration that is ethical. We have basically a corrupt administration who essentially stole the presidency, committed a coup d'etat in this country, and these guys aren't interested in operating according to rational means. They're interested in providing for their friends and supporters and for themselves, and the hell with everything else. And they don't give any second thought to what happens to anyone else in the world, never mind just the citizens of the United States.
Well, I don't know. You want to comment on that at all? Well, we'll give the caller the last word there with the promise that I'm sure on future shows we'll get back to some of these issues. But for the moment, we'll leave it there. Our guest, Julian Palmore, he is professor of mathematics at University of Illinois. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.